Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, there's a lot to know and think about when it comes to preparing for the end of our lives. And we have a guest today who has created a guide to help you and I live as well as possible for as long as possible. Katie Butler, our guest, an author and a journalist whose work has been published in lots of places, New York Times Magazine, Wall Street Journal, The Best American Science Writing, and more. And her latest book is titled The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What questions you have about preparing for the end of life as we age? Oh, maybe you have questions about relatives and those who may have passed. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Katie Butler, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure, Larry. Thank you for having me.
I really enjoyed reading your book. I found it really interesting, especially, and we can talk about this a little later, the great examples you use really helps bring the story to life. What made you decide to write this book? You talk about that right away in the beginning.
Yeah, I wrote about it for a couple of reasons. The first was that my dad had a very prolonged and painful decline and end of life, and I wanted to make sure that I could do it better for myself and my friends, and I wanted to see what we could contribute. And also because in the old days when medicine was very ineffective, dying was really regarded as a spiritual ordeal rather than a medicalized procedure. And there was actually a book called The Art of Dying that was put out first in the 1400s, which was a spiritual guide to a meaningful and as peaceful as possible death. And I realized we needed a new book for a new era where we do have effective medicine, but that effective medicine can also sometimes go too far and give people very painful, highly technological deaths, and not everybody wants that.
Yeah.
So those are the two reasons, but I just have to throw in, this is such an interesting time for you and I to be talking about this because, of course, with the virus, yeah, we're both very aware of our own fragility and the reality that we could die randomly. And I think a lot of us are very heightened in our fear that we will die and we want to avoid it. So I just want to put that on the table, that we have an opportunity to hear to really think about how we would like our deaths to go, even though we're in a moment where we're obviously doing everything we can to protect people we love from getting a virus that they might be vulnerable
to. Yeah, I thought it was really, you know, we'd planned to have you on quite a while back, and of course it's only been a couple of, less than 2 weeks, really, where things had so drastically changed in the country.
Yeah.
Boy, oh boy. And you're right. I think a lot of people would like to spend the end of their lives at home.
Yes.
And, you know, at some place you know.
Yeah.
But it doesn't happen for so many of us, probably maybe most of us.
Exactly. 70% of people say they want to die at home. And I think a lot of that is a desire to die as a full human being and not as a bundle of diagnoses, and not to be surrounded by strangers or to have high-tech delaying the inevitable. But the reality is a fifth of us die in an intensive care unit, and only about a half the number of people who say they want to die at home actually do die at home. So in the book, I also talk about how to make a hospital death or a nursing home death as sacred and peaceful as possible. Sometimes we are going to have to improvise in a situation that is not ideal, what we would have wished for.
Yeah. I like how you organized your book, because your first three chapters focus on living well right now.
Yes. Yes. And what I learned from the research that I did was it's almost never too late that changing your eating habits or getting a half hour of vigorous exercise a day is going to drastically reduce your rate of developing dementia, for example, or having a long, painful, highly disabled decline.
Yeah.
And even if you're over 65, even if you've had bad habits for a very long time, you can actually, people in the book, I include people in the book, which is The Art of Dying Well, I include them describing the amazing turnarounds that they did after the age of 65 and how much it has improved their well-being.
Yeah, you know, I think it was Tom Murphy, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
Well, explain what he did. He just took it upon himself.
Yes, he got a big wake-up call. He was over 200 pounds. He was eating what I would call eating diabetically, you know, eating in a way to create diabetes. And he went to a new primary care doctor. All of his numbers were off the scales. And he basically pleaded with her and said, okay, I'll take high blood pressure medicine, but please give me 3 months to see if I can turn this around before I go on statins or other drugs. And he made a radical change. He stopped essentially eating sugar, and he began to jog very, very slowly, gradually increasing. And he said it was incredibly difficult, but within 6 months, all his numbers were normal or extremely close to normal, and he is taking no meds whatsoever. Yeah. So, and the point of the structure of the book was that old age or chronic illness are not monolithic states. We actually need to understand a series of health stages, and at each health stage, we need to pivot slightly in our relationship to medicine into what we should be focusing on, and the realities and the limits of the treatments that medicine has to offer us. So if you're in early old age and you're very vigorous, you might want to go for a certain surgery. But if you're in a much later stage of life that I call the house of cards, when you're extremely fragile, any kind of hospital stay is likely to push you over the edge. So something that might have been the perfect thing for you a decade earlier now becomes a true disaster.
Talking today with Katie Butler, her book is titled The Art of Dying Well, subtitle, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. And inviting your questions or comments or maybe experiences as we move along today, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Daryl in Couderay will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, Larry and Katie.
Hi.
I believe dying is only passing from one reality to another.
Yeah.
I'm sure my spirit will have to make an adjustment, but the same thing happened when I got born. And that was a big adjustment, but I survived, and I'll be 71 this year. In the end, on my last day and days, I hope I will not be in pain, so I try to take care of myself health-wise as best I can.
Beautiful. Yes, and I think framing one's end of life in a way that creates a peaceful, meaningful frame is incredibly important. And the book actually includes some rituals which are not specifically religious in the sense that you don't have to have a particular religious outlook to find them comforting and meaningful.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll take some other calls as well as we move along today in the show. You, that first part, one of the things I kind of thought about or liked and then thought about my own situation is has to do with getting to know your neighbor, this part of living well, getting to know your neighbors. Talk about living well and living wills and advanced directives. We're going to be talking, after you and I are completed today, we're going to be talking about palliative care, and that's part of your book as well.
Absolutely. There aren't enough palliative care doctors to go around. There aren't enough geriatrics doctors to go around. And I wanted to provide people with the maximum numbers of sort of tips and guidance that could help people, whether or not they can find a way to palliative care or geriatrics, both of which are just invaluable at these later stages of life. And I would say the main thing I learned in the course of researching and thinking about the book myself, because I'm 71 myself, is how important community is as we move into these more vulnerable stages of life, and how meaningful it is to help out our neighbors when we can, and also create something of a gratitude bank in the neighborhood so that we don't feel embarrassed to ask a neighbor for help when we need it. So that person that you babysit today, maybe tomorrow they're going to pick up a prescription for you at the, you know, at the pharmacy when you can't get there yourself.
Yeah, I was thinking about that and thought about my own neighborhood and the friends I have in the neighborhood and how we kind of exchange, favors or what have you. And it's really part of a great life to have a good community, for sure.
Yeah.
Tanya in Oconomowoc has a question for you. Let's go there. Tanya, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
So, yeah, my question is, I actually live with my grandparents who both have Alzheimer's and dementia. And rapidly declining. They moved out of their dream home 2 years ago. Recently got in a car wreck. So it's just even more rapidly declining. So I just was looking for advice, I guess, as to what you would recommend, you know, because I think because they can't drive.
Yeah.
They don't live in their home that they used to love.
Yeah.
Is really, increasing their decline.
Yeah, and it's very, very tough because we really don't have, and I want to congratulate you for stepping up the way you obviously are and supporting and loving them.
For sure.
Which is stressful on you, and make sure you get support too. I think these very important sort of existential life and death questions come up at this stage, which is what is appropriate medical care for them and what is not. A lot of what people at this stage often want is supportive home care and comfort care, but it could be actually cruel to put them through a hospital stay because they are likely, frankly, to deteriorate much further from being in a hospital or being in an ER than they will if you can keep them at home. So one possibility, which is not available everywhere, is there some kind of home health aid? Like a nursing care service or a physician house call service so that you could bring some medical services into the home rather than stress them by taking them outside. Another option, there's a wonderful federal program called PACE. But unfortunately, it is not very widely available, but it is a tremendous support for people in your position who are trying to keep relatives at home and out of nursing homes.
What does it do?
It provides an absolute team approach, everything from daycare programs, so the caregiver gets some relief, to someone coming in the home and making sure it's not cluttered and you don't have fall risks, providing van service to all medical appointments so that, again, the caregiver is not always being exhausted, sending all the meds home.
No.
It's what everybody needs maybe in that last 2 years of life, but it's only available in little pockets of the country. But you could look up PACE, which is P-A-C-E. It's the PACE program. And it stands for, I think, Advanced Care for the Program for Advanced Care for the Elderly.
Yeah. Tanya?
I hope, does that settle, does that answer your question, Tanya? Are you still on the line? No, she gone?
Yeah, I'm still here. It does. It's interesting. We have some care providers that come in, and I just see it stressing my mom out because she takes on a huge load of this, and my uncle.
Yeah.
And I just, and unfortunately they forget the care providers who come in having the Alzheimer's, and so they actually get very defensive at times.
Yeah. There's sort of more detail in my book. You might find it helpful.
Yeah, you have some pretty good examples in your book of the situation Tanya's in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was in it with my dad and my mom. And I had to also, there came a point, my dad was given a pacemaker, which we felt, my mother and I came to feel was cruelly prolonging his most unhappy and miserable time of life. And a bioethicist recommended that I imagine having a conversation with my dad as if he was, imagine him coming back for 15 minutes, fully present, fully cognizant, and asking him for advice about what kind of medical care he would want and not want. And that was extremely helpful in supporting me to ask my dad's doctors to turn off his pacemaker. They did refuse, but I know my mother and I, in retrospect, did the right thing because he was in the last 6 months of his life, and he was absolutely miserable.
Yeah,
and he did die on hospice eventually.
Tanya, thank you so much for calling. Visiting today with Katie Butler, her book called titled The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. I'm Larry Mueller. Bill Martin's our on-air producer today. Natalie Guyette, our producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Larry Mueller here. We are talking today with Katie Butler, author of the book The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. Certainly, if you have questions, comments, or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us from ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Rona in Cameron, thank you for calling.
Hi, Rona.
Hi, Larry. Good morning. Good morning to your guests. I'm an only child, and my mom and dad live 4 hours away. So when my dad, Parkinson's and Lewy body got too much for my mom, she said, nursing home or go live with your daughter. So my dad came to live with us, and we were happy to have dad with us. And it was a big decision. My family embraced the decision. My husband was supportive, wouldn't have made it through it without all of their help. But I want to say that for me, the bigger struggle would have been to wonder every day for 3 years what was going on with my dad in that nursing home. When he was at our house, I knew every day what was going on because I was part of the evening shift for Care Ritual. I still had a full-time job. And it gave me 3 more years every day with my dad. And for that, I will be eternally and grateful. When he passed, I was able to be there with him, and I snuggled up next to him, and for me, it was a wonderful experience, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Yeah,
and it can be very heartwarming. The other side of that is my mom is on the total other end of the spectrum, and she will not pass well because of some paranoia she has. And I learned from my dad to start thinking about these things now, because when my time comes, I want that experience my dad had. I want that for myself.
Yes. Beautiful. And how do you plan on making that happen, or that you want the kind of experience that your dad had?
We're talking with our children right now because they lived through what they saw Grandpa go through. They saw it. They knew what the expectation of my husband and myself were, and we had care workers that came in, and thank goodness for those CNAs.
Yeah.
But we're just starting conversations now. We're just in our 60s.
Yeah.
If we don't start the conversations now and just work on them gradually over time to just all of a sudden say, hi, here I am, that wouldn't be fair to them.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So,
was your dad on hospice before he died?
You know, just a week before, because my dad is a bohemian farmer and stubborn as long as the day is, would never, hardly ever admit to pain. If he took a Tylenol, I knew he had pain. If he took two Tylenol, I knew he had a lot of pain, and we didn't realize the pain he had until almost that week before. Then we started hospice.
Wow.
One morning he had a big, giant breakfast, and I thought, wow, Dad, what's going on? And 2 days later, after that, he didn't eat or drink a thing again, and 2 days later he passed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your call, Rona. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, I have a thought about that, which is there is such a thing as a good death, and that doesn't necessarily mean that the person dying is all spiritual and accepting necessarily, but it does mean that we are supporting them well. And I think, you know, obviously your past caller and all of us who've been involved in caregiving can look back with a great deal of pride and self-confidence for really helping the people that we love have a well-supported, peaceful death, hopefully one in which pain is well-controlled, which it can be now in a way that in medieval times it usually wasn't.
You know, we just let me go back to Rona's comment about her mother.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what your advice might be to her. She said her mother was kind of paranoid about death.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then how do you, as...
Well, yeah, I have, you know, a couple of thoughts. And one is, you know, the famous airline advice, which is if the masks drop from the ceiling, put on your own one first before you put one onto the kid or the elder that you're looking after. There are limits to what caregivers can do, and people cannot always emotionally or financially or practically handle having someone in their house, and they may have to go into a nursing home. So I think it's important not to beat ourselves up if it's really beyond us. The other thing is that the hospice movement talks a lot about emotional tasks of the end of life, which are thank you, I love you, please forgive me, I forgive you, and goodbye. And I think it's important for those of us that are relatively younger and looking at people that we are closer to their ends, that we do that work with them ahead of time. We don't have to say, hey, I know you're going to die, you know, but you can. I wrote legacy letters to my dad for several years thanking him for teaching me to swim and teaching me to read and really reliving our early childhood love for each other. And I think the more we clean up our relationships before those last crises, it's not going to make them all perfect or simple, but it's going to help. And so I would just advise, do what you can to clean your side of the street. You know, if you're Rhoda or Rhonda, you know, there's ways to ease it and to clear up some of the debris of life ahead of time.
Yeah. You quote Matthew O'Reilly, I believe, who said people ask, he's seen many people die, and the three pieces of unfinished business that they want to know about when they're dying. They, you know, they have regrets and they want to be forgiven. They fear they will be forgotten and hope to be remembered, and they want to know their lives had meaning.
Yes. I think this feeling that our lives had meaning, that they were part of some larger tapestry, that we contributed in some way to the lives of others, I think we really hunger more than we know through our entire lives to satisfy that need. And that is, I think, the strange gift of a moment like the moment we're in right now, which is we do have an opportunity, and especially if we get told to shelter in place, which we are here in California, and I think we are here too. It really is an opportunity to slow down and assess and realize the ways that we truly have contributed to the lives of others and that we want to do so in the future.
Yeah. It is nice to see. I think the program just before this one, people were talking about the fact that we are now, forced to spend time with our families, and we're looking at You know, as I do my walk, you know, I just do a little jogging, 2-3 miles in the morning or most days, and I see people out together, families together.
Yeah.
In the out of doors, walking along the lake or whatever, and it's something I didn't see as much of before all this happened.
Yeah. Absolutely, and I also think it's important to remember that not everybody is going to want to go into an intensive care unit if they have this virus and they become seriously ill. Some people are going to want to go and are going to have a very good shot at surviving if they do get intense supportive hospital care. But there are other people who are closer to the end of life, who have multiple serious illnesses, who have already decided long before this that they were more happy diverting into something like hospice or dying at home or having comfort care. And this virus doesn't change that. I'm not saying, I mean, I think this is a decision everybody makes individually, but doctors and nurses describe intensive care as, quote, torture when people are in there whose chance of survival is low or non-existent. They feel what's called moral distress. And I think it's very important in a moment like this to really check in with ourselves, our basic state of health, and what do we really want.
Our guest today, Katie Butler, her book, The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. Talking with her and certainly looking forward to your questions or comments. Richard in Manitowoc has something for us. Let's go there. Richard, hello.
Hello. I got a question for Katie.
Okay.
And I have a specific example if you want to hear it. But I want to hear your opinion on self-euthanasia.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I often get this question. Obviously, there is a large nationwide movement saying that many people would like to be able to time the end of their lives if they have a terminal illness. And I live in California, which recently approved, it's now legal. Some people call it death with dignity or the right to die. It's legal in my state now. I personally think it's appropriate that people have this as an option and a choice. But I also want to caution that there are large, large numbers of people for whom, for one reason or another, this doesn't feel like a fit for them. And we need to also really concentrate on providing people with a sense of medical autonomy, that they don't have to go on dialysis if they don't want to go on dialysis, for example. They don't have to go in ICU if they don't want to go in ICU. They don't have to get that fourth or fifth round of chemo if they are really tired, exhausted, and really out of options. So
what you call slow medicine.
Yes, what I call slow medicine, which is another, it's an international movement, the slow medicine movement, which is akin to the slow food movement, which is you want to be really thoughtful. You want to only access medical care that really helps you and serves your own deepest values and goals, and not simply feel that you're being funneled into prolonging life to the very last moment, whether or not that is what you want.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, I want to go back to the caller, a previous caller who, and we were talking about this, the COVID-19 business. And one of the issues, I think, and I just wonder what your comment is on this, for a person who is going to really be seriously affected by this and probably die, I think a fear of that might be the fact that your family can't be around
yeah.
you.
Yeah. I think it's so tragic because our need for meaningful ritual for every religion and culture in the world practically has had a ritual of washing and preparing the bodies of the dead, often by family members. I think we're going to have to get creative with programs like Zoom so that at least we can have some sense of a virtual death watch, a virtual vigil. Other than that, I mean, I'm not a doctor, so I don't know enough about the kinds of hand washing and infection control that we are going to have or whether there are any workarounds. But I think we're really going to hunger for this. I have a ritual to suggest, though. Jewish people have a ritual called the Yahrzeit candle, which is a one-year anniversary candle which burns for 24 hours straight. And every year I do a homemade ritual for my parents where I put up their photographs, I put flowers just on a little makeshift altar, just a little bench, and I light this candle. It's very safe. It's like a votary, and it burns for 24 hours. And it reminds me of their beauty and their strength and what they created in this world, and it puts me at peace. And so I want to just strongly suggest that we create some versions of ritual, even if we just have a photograph of the person with us. It will soothe our own souls.
Let's take another call. And Richard, thank you for calling. Lori in Hales Corners, I think it's your turn. Hi, Lori.
Yeah, hi. I'm kind of an intuitive person, Larry, and thank you for this program. It makes perfect sense to me. I think I've asked some of the same questions about should a person be expected to stay on whatever ritual they're on, even though it's just yucky and is unmeaningful and unhelpful. You know, that doesn't sound right to me either. So my doctor, it was interesting. She and one of her other staff also reinforced it, the idea of offering me a bracelet, you know, one of those do not resuscitate things.
Uh-huh.
You fill out a card and you get a bracelet and all that. And I've done that. My husband has not. So,
yeah.
Well, hey, I guess we give each other space, right? You know, that's the way I call it. And then I remember a lady who was a member of our church, and just a nice lady, and she had been in the hospital, and I forget what her illness was. She came out, and I noticed her complexion, and I sort of yellowish,
yeah.
And I thought, oh, that looks familiar, and yep, I think she had something chronically wrong with her. She was back in the hospital within days of my noticing that.
Yeah.
And I went to visit her.
Yeah.
And she was miserable. She was, she was down in bed and they had this drip in there and that. And she was down in bed. And she was not enjoying life and it looked like she wouldn't again.
Well, we lost her here, I think I know where Lori was going with this. Here's her friend, miserable in the hospital, and it probably had some terrible effects on her own end of life decisions.
Yeah, and I think we really have to listen to people. The default of our medical system right now is to assume that everybody wants to extend their lives as long as possible, no matter what the financial, emotional, physical costs, etc. And that is actually not the case. A lot more regular citizens are more concerned about things like their well-being and how well they are functioning. And those are actually as important or more important to them than living to the very, very last inch that can be eked out. And so if we're doctors or nurses, I think it's very important that we actually draw out patients and truly listen to them. when they say something like no more hospitals or why am I still alive? I mean, people say these things, and we need to really listen to them when they're saying that and really draw out what their goals are rather than just impose goals upon them. And the same for family members. Our family members may get to the point where they say, I don't care. I do not want that surgery. Or I do not want to go into the hospital again for any reason. The last time was just too traumatic. We need to really listen to them, even though it means we have to have the courage to say goodbye to someone that we deeply love and maybe we don't feel ready to let go.
Yeah. Ruth in Madison has something for us. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share with you, it goes right along with what you're saying. I have my advance directive that is ready, and if there's time, I just want to share a couple paragraphs from it. This is so important. My mother did it, and I followed her example. So it starts out with, to my family, my physician, and to any medical facility in whose care I happen to be, to any individual who may become responsible for my health, welfare, and affairs. Death is as much a reality as birth, growth, maturity, and old age. It is certainly one certainty in life. If the time comes when I can no longer take part in decisions for my future, let this statement stand as an expression of my wishes while I am of sound mind. I just had mine re-notarized. And it says, to my dear ones, I have lived a life with dignity and I want to die the same way. If I should become old, ill, or injured and unable to make a rational decision, you are to instruct the attending physicians that he or she is not to attempt to prolong my life by using extraordinary measures of any kind. If I am stricken with an illness that is irreversible, and I am unable to speak for myself, please speak for me.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I actually have a very detailed dementia directive in the book, which is my directive if I have dementia. And it really spells out what a lot of people call comfort care or comfort measures only. It says very clearly, keep me peaceful, keep pain control, but do not give me antibiotics. Do not give me a pacemaker. If I have one, turn it off. Don't put me on dialysis. It really goes down the whole list so that I want the people that I love to have the least second guessing, the least opportunities for guilt possible. And I think a beautiful directive like the one that caller just read out loud, which makes our deepest philosophy clear and isn't just a checkbox list, I think it's extremely helpful. There's one I recommend highly. It's called Five Wishes. It's actually available free online now during the virus epidemic. It's called Five Wishes. And it is, I don't know about Wisconsin, but if you go on that website of, I think it's, Dying with Dignity or Aging Dignity. But if you just Google Five Wishes, you will find it. It's legal in most states, but it also has a spiritual component. It says things like, I would like to be massaged with oil if I'm at home, and that makes sense. I would like the following religious texts or poems read to me. This is the music that I would like for my funeral service or memorial service. So it really rounds it out. So it's a soul document and an emotional document and not just a legalistic document. And I think it makes it a lot easier for some people to fill it out.
And you have some other lists and certainly a lot of great suggestions. We've added the five wishes to our show notes so people go to that. And we certainly haven't gotten into everything you talk about, Katie, but I really appreciate, I'm glad you wrote the book for sure. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Perhaps we'll have a chance to talk again.
Thank you so much. I very much appreciate it, Larry. And good wishes to everybody in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and good health. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
by Katie Butler. She's a best-selling author of Knocking on Heaven's Door was another one of her books. This book, the book we were talking about today, is The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. And speaking about that, a lot of times people want have a good end of life in part because they've had palliative care. And we're going to be talking about palliative care next, and really kind of goes along with what we've just discussed today. But our guest today, Dr. Toby Campbell, up next to talk with us about palliative care. I'm Larry Mueller.